This is an interview with Thomas R. Rhodes of 101 Sylvania Avenue in Greenville, South Carolina. The tape is being interview is being done for Youngstown State University Oral History Department. The interviewer is Lillian Emenheiser, and this is August 8th, 1975, and it is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. First, let's talk a little bit about the progression you made in your railroad career. Where did you work first?
I was employed as carman for the Southern Railroad from 1918 until February of 1921, serving the last year and a half as car inspector. This time, restate that. On February, I was laid off with a force reduction. I never stood for any more work with the Southern until 1927. In 1927, I had been working with Piedmont Northern since January of 24, and by choice, I stayed with the P&N as car inspector, located in Greenwood, SC. In 1933, I transferred from the mechanical department to the transportation department and ran an engine as locomotive engineer and passenger engineer until June the 14th, 1941. In 1941, I was promoted to trainmaster for South Carolina Division, which operated between Greenwood and Spartanburg, South Carolina. V.I.A. Anderson with an 11-mile range between Belton and Anderson. I continued as trainmaster from June 41 until June 46. June 46, I was made division superintendent of headquarters in Greenville. In this capacity, I continued until June of 52. In June of 52, I had additional duties attached to my present duties as superintendent of motor power on both the North and South Carolina divisions, in addition to division superintendent. This position was held until the merger between the Piedmont and Northern and Seaboard Coastline Railway on July 1, 1969. At that time, I retired from active duty.
You went to work with the Piedmont there in 1924. As a car inspector, what does a car inspector do?
Well, on a small railroad such as we had, In those days, we were operating with electric locomotives and electric passenger trains. It was the duty of car inspectors to inspect cars, freight cars of all, that is, all types of equipment received through interchange from the Seaboard Railroad to the Piedmont Northern. Car inspector duties can get right complicated inasmuch as you are responsible for the mechanical and operating condition of all equipment that you receive. And any of it that might be abused, or we'd say like a wreck where box cars, tank cars, flat cars, what have you, have been sideswiped or derailed and have been damaged, yet they're able to continue on in their movement without any likelihood of derailment. But at the same time, you might have several $1,000s worth of damage to the piece of equipment. Well, it's the inspector's duty to note and secure what we call a defect card, making the Seaboard responsible for that damage that exists at the time it's offered to you for interchange. Then after that defect card is attached to the car, which rides there until the car is on its home road, then repaired, and then they bill the road who issued the card for the repairs that was actually made of the damage that was done. That's number one duty. Number two duty is your duty to look after the rolling equipment of your own, such as engines and passenger coaches. There was always Greenwood was a terminal, and our equipment lay over in Greenwood during the assignment. And then at that time, while you repaired the engine or the passenger car or whatever you needed, in addition to your duties as an inspector. Going from there to the transportation department, of course, we had passenger train assignments out of Greenwood, we had freight train assignments out of Greenwood that operated between Greenwood and Spartanburg, and all employees were on a seniority roster, and being the youngest engineer in 1933, I just had to take what was left, and the older boys stopped off. We had some jobs that made a round trip to Spartanburg and back, and we had some, well, all of our freight trains lay over in Spartanburg and back to Greenwood, you go up one day and back the next. But our passenger assignments, you would make the round trip in 8 hours. Well, it continued as that, as I say, until 1941, at which time I was made train master. And of course, the duties of a train master covers 24 hours a day from one end of the road to the other. Also looking after and seeing that the crews were properly lined up, or see that they were in shape to work when they did report. It covered quite a bit of territory, and it required, as I say, you go 24-hour call, you might get home one night, you might not get home that night. You might be gone a couple, 3 days at a time, but it was always on the division somewhere during that time. Then on a small railroad, your duties exceeded some of those on the larger railroads, because you just couldn't afford to have a man for every long screwdriver, every short screwdriver either. You have to be able to use both of them, so to speak. Take, for instance, derailments. It was necessary that the train be at or close to the derailments and see that everything was carried out as quickly as possible and expedite the clearing of the main line or the industrial track or whatever the case where the derailment was. And of course, from the train master's position on to the superintendent's position, why, that just included more responsibility because then you looked after the train master and the rest of the railroad also. Hiring of employees, looking over passing or rejecting the applicants. Then it was also imperative for the small railroad to see that all of the receivers or customers of ours that got the best service that could be had and to see that they were all satisfied, that all the crews were doing the work that they were assigned to do without shortcutting the customer. There again, you assume more responsibility in the operation of the motive power. The master mechanic reported to you as well as the train master. We always had a good working team, but we had no great big problems except it was just quite a interesting thing to follow all the strings that you had leading through your fingers to see that everybody concerned had gotten what he paid for or what he was paid for.
When you went out to hire a crew or hire a person to work on the railroad, did you have exams you gave them or?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a pretty rigid written examination as well as an oral examination. that is for training. That was not literally true with the majority of the clerks, but all trainmen, engineers, conductors, and brakemen stood a rigid physical examination as well as a written examination on train rules, on operating rules. After in the mechanic department, I say the mechanical department, those coming out of the mechanical department for a good many years, we pulled our engineers out of the mechanical department because they knew so much more about the equipment. And then you had a written examination for train rules for that mechanical man when he entered the service of the transportation department. After we, in 1951, we transferred from all electric to diesel operation. And after we started our diesel operation, then we started promoting our engineers from a brakeman or a flagman, those who showed an interest in going to what we call the head end or the rear. The rear end was a conductor, the head was an engineer. And whoever showed that interest, well, then we gave him a permit and allowed him to operate for about 2 years under the supervision of the old engineer. And then he had to get 5 engineers to sign his permit that he was able and capable of operating the locomotive himself.
Did he hold the position of fireman or something like that?
No, he was either a head brakeman or a rear brakeman.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, operating electrically, we never had any firemen.
Mm-hmm.
And after we dieselized, we continued operating without what we call the fireman.
Well, it was on most of the railroads, the fireman was part of the crew. As such, And did you just have a different set of people that made up the crew on the diesels?
That's right. We, instead of the fireman, we used the head brakeman to ride on that side of the engine.
Did these men have to go in periodically and be re-examined during their lifetime on the railroad?
At a certain age, it varied. But under my regime, we didn't have another examination unless the employee showed signs of. We observed something that looked like it was necessary for him to be re-examined until he reached 65. After reaching the age of 65, then more particularly a physical to engineers.
Were you working for the railroad that time they had that big wreck up on the Ennery River?
No, I was with the Southern Railroad when that car went over. Mm-hmm. I helped pick it up. But I was working with the Derrick at that time when we picked that up.
When was that? That was
1919, I believe.
Yeah.
If you want to, I can get you today.
Oh, that's all right. Right now, we might look later. Coming back here to the car inspector. Now, you worked within a yard, with everything that came into a yard from another foreign railroad.
That's correct.
Now on your home railroad, you also inspected the
home equipment. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I wanted to ask you, what would cause a car to get sideswiped on the road?
Well, it's callouses on somebody's part. You either didn't push a car in the clear with a passing train, or you showed one out too far with another passing train. In other words, adjacent tracks where one comes into the other. Well, there is a fouling point, and if you don't clear that fouling point, then you've got a sideswipe. In getting back to the defect card, not only would you have damage from a sideswipe, you could also get damage from impacts. You could also, where they hit too hard in coupling, you'd also have damage from derailments, that even where cars are completely turned over on the side, then you would get a tremendous amount of damage, and that is a carrier's liability.
On this electric road, what would cause a car to derail?
Oh, various things. Mm-hmm. Various things. You could have bad track. Well, I mean, that's true on here, where it's electric or where it's diesel or what have you. But most of your derailments occur from bad track. And then you've got various other things, like a jaw head falling down and striking an axle and picking the car up, tumbling it up. Take a boxcar, and it only has an inch and an eighth of steel planes that holds it right on the rail, so you don't have to come up high before it leaves the track. Now, a track can spread and your cars can fall in and it'll cause a derail. A flange can break. And on that broken flange, you take a piece come out of a flange like that, 12, 15, 18 inches on a curve. When that broken place comes down, there's nothing to hold it on there. Then it just climbs right over the rail and goes to the woods. Various things can cause derailment. I remember many years ago, the Atlantic coastline was in high competition with the seaboard, particularly the passenger trains between Richmond in Miami. The Seaboard was running rings around the coastline, who was operating the steam, and they were operating the diesel. So the president of the coastline elected to build, or had built, some high-speed steam engines that were supposed to done 110 miles an hour. Well, it did. They got that fast. But they liked to broke up the railroad, bend and rail, and they couldn't figure out what was bend and rail. So they had Baldwin built these engines for the coastline. Before they ever found out what was bend and rail, they mounted cameras on each side of the tender, focused on the drivers and the locomotive. And they found, from the film alone, that driving wheel, which the crank pin was anchored to at that high speed, was leaving the rail that high. And when it comes back down, there's a pop bending that rail and breaking it in some cases. So it just shows you how freakish things can happen.
Were they able to make any adjustments in them, or did they have to discontinue the
use? They just discontinued at high speed. They found out that they couldn't compete with the diesel speed, so they cut the steam engine back to where at a certain speed, I think it's somewhere around 70 miles an hour, that this driver began to pick up, and the faster it got, the higher it would pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So they just reduced the speed to discontinue that damaging of the rail. And then, of course, met the competitor with the same competition with diesel power.
It's my understanding that passenger steam engines had higher wheels.
Your passenger steam engines, the drivers range anywhere from 72 to 96 inches, where all of your diesel power wheels are standard is 42 inches.
Now, in freight steam engines, what size drivers?
Well, the freight engines were much lower. They ranged to somewhere around 5 feet in diameter, or height.
When you go out to clean up a wreck, what, first of all, did you had certain forms you made out on your observations of the wreck? Is that right? Or reports or something?
Oh yes. The first thing you would do, if you could, was ascertain what caused the derailment. Then from there on, if you're satisfied with your own self or the committee who was doing the investigation agreed on what caused the derailment, then the next thing was to immediately clear the wreck as soon as possible. Our worst wrecks that we ever encountered was caused by people tampering with switches and leaving the switches cocked or open, whichever the case might be. I think one of the worst things I ever had to contend with was pulled or helped get through a conductor and engineer who I had run the open pool for many years at the time I was an engineer, and then later on served as train master and superintendent. We had a 14-year-old youngster, Ed Greer, who knocked the lock off of the switch late in the afternoon. I said late in the afternoon, about 4 o'clock. And at that particular point, the sun was shining right in the front of the locomotive. It was hard to pick up colors that far back. But it was a dead-end track and a trestle on the back of it. And this train went into that siding. The siding was only about 300 feet long from switch point to the bottom of the chute. Maybe 350. I've forgotten the exact. But anyway, the engine and four or five cars went over the chute just completely. And it was a diesel, road switcher diesel, and a big tank car right behind the engine come right in on top of the cab of the engine, the pressure cab right down on the engineer and conductor, if you ever know. I had to stand by and see the wheel cut out with 70 parts. That was one of the worst experiences I ever had as far as a derailment was concerned.
What type of equipment did they use to clear up the various wrecks?
Well, you either had a big derrick for a battery, or if the derailment wasn't real bad, well, then you had jacks, air jacks, with 50 or 60 ton jacks, you know, and we had a couple of those air jacks to the reservoir, one of the locomotives where we get air there, and then we would jack cars and skid and all. But air jacks, re-railers, and derricks is two or three things that is a necessity to re-rail cars after derailment.
On the, what was the difference, well, on the passenger trains, when you worked on, as an engineer, did you handle freight or passenger?
Both.
Both. What is there on an electric railroad to being an electric engineer, on engineering the train? It's different from the steam.
Well, the only difference is a different, I mean, as far as your operation is concerned, it's identical, except for the equipment. The equipment, of course, is entirely different, electric from steam, also electric from diesel. Now, diesel electric is not a great deal of difference in equipment. make your own power as you go with the diesel. There's quite a difference in the voltage of diesel and all electric. Our all electric engine operated on 1600 volts DC, and the diesel equipment, the highest voltage you get is 600 volts. Now, on electric, we picked up our current from the catenary system. On an average of about every 10 miles, we had an automatic substation that converted 44,000 volts AC to 1600 volts DC. Some of that was done by a rotary generator, some of it was done by converters, some of it was done by mercury arc electric pots, which fires anodes into a bowl of mercury, of AC current, and then it comes out as DC current, converted to 1600 volts. It was necessary to have at least 20 gallons of water per minute in those mercury arc rectifiers in order to keep the rectifier cool under his own. The catenary system was often expensive to operate, and it was particularly bad in the wintertime right through this area because of ice. The wires freezing, you know, and you couldn't make good contact with a pantograph or a trolley pole either with that ice on the hazard system. You'd invariably burn the overhead down if you still tried to operate in ice, because if you were operating there and draw an arc that far with that 1600 volts, just cut that wire off just like sticking acetylene torch there. Then you were sold up, then you get the overhead crowd in and put the overhead back up before you could move again. Now the operation, as far as engineers themselves are concerned, the air brake equipment on one is identical to the other. All of your locomotives are equipped by and large in the same type. Air brake, of course, Westinghouse developed and played a big part in railway braking systems. The brake valve was practically the same thing as electric, and it was steam, and it was practically the same thing as it was diesel.
Where did the P&N get its equipment? Who made it?
Well, we have General Electric built six of our engines back in 1912 and 13. Westinghouse built four or five at that same time. Then later on, in starting about the time I went to the railroad in 24, we began to buy the motors either from GE or Westinghouse and trucks, and built. We put two engines together and called them an articulated engine, built them out here in our old shop here in Greenville. We built several. In fact, we built one as late as 1949, before dieselizing in 51. That was my pride and joy, because I played such a big part in it, and it was a master. We just didn't have enough power. it would pull this, the substation off the floor. Beautiful piece of equipment. I got a big picture of it. I hate it, you know, all the land to see it go to the scrap pile.
I was just going to ask you, did they preserve any of those engines?
We have one down in Atlanta, in the museum down there, that was refurbished in our shop here in 64, I believe, 64, 65, and then moved down to Atlanta.
One of the early engines?
Yeah, one of them was built by GE in 1914.
Now, who built the passenger cars for us?
Well, they were also, the majority of them were built by Budd and had Westinghouse equipment. They were multiple cars. You could operate five units, and you could do the same thing with those small freight engine. We would run two and three of those together. One engineer could operate three of them. And on the passenger equipment, we never operated over three of them. Mm-hmm. Passenger cars. We'd use a deadhead to pull them. Or say drag the one. We had a four car train and a five car train. We would operate three of them, drag the other two over. We found that even though you could operate five of them, we found that you got a little better service out of them. Apparently you lost some voltage somewhere in the control for the fifth unit in particular. So we found that the operation was better just by making 3 units.
Now, when you put several units together and the passenger, did each one have its own trolley pole or?
Well, you could use it either way. We found, we later on did away with the trolley pole altogether and used a pantograph system.
Yeah.
But we, with a pantograph, we just used one pantograph and used a jumper from each coach to carry the 1,600 volts from one motor to the other.
You never did use any of the Brill cars.
Some of the early cars, I believe, were built by Brill.
Did they get some early ones from the Pennsylvania or something like that?
We never did buy an electric stuff from Pennsylvania, but we bought some trailers from the Pennsylvania that were used on the Long Island commuter system and drove them with freight engines. We operated some special trains, particularly on the weekends, and we'd use one of these little freight engines we built in 1914 by GE. We would take that in here and pull as much as 5 of those Pennsylvania trailers and load it with passengers. Our crew was operating on those trains and we would handle as many as 1,500 passengers in one day.
I understand they used to run those passenger trains about every 2 hours. How long did this type of commuter service continue?
Well, it lasted, of course it had its ups and downs, but I would say that the passenger business held up real good till 1949. It began to dwindle away after World War II, slowly. The last 2 years that we operated passenger service, we lost about $14,000 in 1950. In the 12 months, and then in 1951, the last year we operated, we had lost $10,000 in 8 months. So you can see how it just gradually dropped off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They never did run any food service on the Piedmont, did they?
Any what?
Food service.
Food service?
Yeah.
I assume you're speaking of dining car service.
Yeah.
No, we never did do that. Your mileage didn't warrant it. The only thing we had in the way of food service was the president had a private car, and making his sightseeing tours over the road, or operating it as as a director special or something of that nature. Well, we always had some mighty good eating on it.
Whatever happened to the equipment they had on that president's car?
It was given to a railroad historical, railroad historical society in Greenwood, South Carolina. And the car is now stored in Greenwood, along with an old Seaboard steam engine. I haven't looked at it myself since it was donated. The Seaboard Coast donated it to him after the merger. late in 69 or early 70, they donated that car to this historical site in Greenwood. Mr. Adams, who was a vice president of Greenwood Mills, played a big hand in securing it for this society there. Someone has told me that they let it go down off of that, and there have been a lot of vandalism on it. Some of the women have broken out there. I just kind of hate to go by and look at it all these years of riding it and enjoying good food on it, and everybody can see it's torn up.
Yeah. Did they have special china and silver that they had made for it?
Yes.
They used to.
Everything was engraved Carolina on it. The silver.
That's the name of the car?
Carolina.
Yeah. That's interesting. What type of industry did the Piedmont service?
Well, primarily textile. And all, that's the way the Piedmont Northern was originally started, was through the directors of the mills. I say the directors, the presidents of the mills, who were later made directors of the railroad, And when they did, of course, they agreed then. Southern Railroad was serving them at that time, but they weren't getting the service that they thought they ought to have. So when they were approached by Mr. E. Thomason to build this railroad and signed up for it, they agreed that they would give, where possible, an equal 50% of their business to the Piedmont Northern as well as to the Southern Railroad. Now, later on in the years, why, they've got to be quite a bit more diversified, the traffic, so to speak. We weren't altogether dependent then on the textile plants for the incoming and outgoing materials, too. We had, of course, the last few years of our operation, I guess coal was our biggest net revenue sources. We were handling, at the time I retired, on the two divisions, we had three plants, three steam plants on the two divisions that were burning right at 150 cars of coal a day. Of course, that was a pretty nice little chunk of revenue. Now, in addition to that, we had located on both divisions, A&P companies, both meat and grocers in North Carolina and South Carolina, which was good for 25, 30 cars per day. I'd say 50 cars a day in both places, including the meat and groceries and the vegetables. And of course, we had both in North Carolina and South Carolina, we had cotton warehouses that served like the old mills in North and South Carolina. They used the transit grade zone in order to let the cotton flow into the warehouses during the heavy season of picking, and then during the rest of the year, as they needed, they would move it on out of their normal charge. Not much usually to have 50, 75 cars of cotton a day right into the local warehouses here.
Your heaviest tonnage, though, came from coal, probably, didn't it?
The latter years, that's true. Mm-hmm. A good many years we had Winn-Dixie's warehouse located on our track, which is now located on the south. That was a real nice account. Definitely we switched them three times a day and had 7,500 cars of groceries hanging out at one time. Mm-hmm. That was a nice account. Mm-hmm.
How many of these, what proportion of the cars that went over your railroad were owned by your railroad? Do you have any idea?
A very small portion was our own equipment. We were kind of up and down in the equipment deal back in the mid-20s, right after World War I, we bought 175 boxcars to protect what we call the CFD movement. That's cotton factory products from the mills to the bleacheries or to the finishing plants, wherever they might be. Well, we kept that equipment for a good many years, and for some reason or other, I don't know, the management decided it wasn't paying off, so we let the cars just kind of deteriorate and finally cut them up. And then in the late 50s, we had an automobile movement of interior equipment such as roads. Upholstery, a plant located here in Greenville, that required what we call DF loaders, which is a special type of equipment for loading this roads and things in. So we built 50 of those cars to put in a pool between here and Lordstown, between here and Detroit, or wherever the Atlanta and Brooklyn, New York City, wherever the automobile is manufactured by these roads to these plants. And those cars are still in good shape and operating today. Of course, the name has been changed from people going to Seaboard Coastline, and they're still handling. Of course, as you all know, they're not handling as many roads for new cars today as they were before the economy did. But that was a real nice movement to the automobile industry. That was about
'Cause if you had more problems with the wooden structured fleet cars in the earlier years than in the metal structured ones that came along.
We had a lot of problems with the wooden structured cars. That year was a big problem for the wooden cars. We had wooden draft seals, we had wooden center seals, and they were bolted together, and you could really understand a certain snatch of the power of the head end, or something had to give, and they usually absorb it from the beginning.
The draw head's what holds the car together. Do you have any of them ever telescoped, Daniel?
You mean the car?
Yeah.
Well, we never had any telescope unless it was a derailment. Now, if you had a derailment, well, maybe you could get anything. If they ever come uncoupled, why, and which they would, and then they went to telescope. But just kind of normal operation.
So, thinking back here, on the wreck equipment, where you cleared up your wrecks and like that, your derailment, whose equipment did you use?
Well, depending on where the derailment was, in North Carolina, we used the order of the Seaboard theory, which was stationed at Hammond, North Carolina. Or in South Carolina, where we used it to get the service of the Southern Railway there, which was stationed here at Greenville. We didn't have our own dairy. But we were very fortunate in having a working relationship with both the Seaboard and the Southern, and they always came to our rescue. Of course, one of the reasons for that, we did a lot of work for the Southern Railroad, such as detouring their trains. Take the they would block the main line between here and Spartanburg for 24 hours. We might have been as high as 12 to 14 passenger trains a day, an old hourly road between the Spartanburg, just to help them out.
Now, would they have to have a pilot when you
were there? We would use a pilot.
Yeah.
We would use an engineer and a conductor.
Okay. Did you have anything to do with the making up of the train?
No, that is done by the yardmaster or the conductor himself under your supervision.
What railroads did you interchange cars with mostly?
Well, our main energy is the seaboard and the clinch feed. And of course, we did have to change a lot of equipment, but it's not really a major change because of the seaboard and the W.
The C and W, the thing.
Carolina, no question. Also with the ACL. And you see, ACL was a direct competitor of Anderson, Spartanburg, and Greenville with us. At these points, we were very competitive.
ACL being the Atlantic Coast Line.
And after they merged with the Seaboard Coast, we were still a little more competitive than we ever were before, because up until the merger with the Seaboard Coast, the Seaboard was a direct family line with us. But after they merged, then they were direct competitors at Anderson, Beaver, and Spartanburg. As a matter of fact, that is one of the reasons that our decision, the management's decision, was to merge because of that high competition. Before, the Seaboard turned everything to be our way. I just thought we'd make the radio in Chicago or Memphis. We know where it is. Even though they've got it coming into this area, they never got it. They take their long haul and give it to us for completion.
Did you get most of your coal off the clinch field?
I'd say 90% of it came from the clinch field and 10% of it from the L&E. And that was beyond the Seaboard.
Okay, L&E is Louisville, Nashville.
Which is now part of the Seaboard group.
On these, when you had to run the Southern around over your road, you know, and you put a pilot on, did that short you on your cruise, or what did you do?
Well, yes, it occasionally it would work a hardship on us, and put it that way, but being such a short run, you had only an hour, 45 minutes to an hour from here to Spartanburg, you know, so we could use an automobile and double that man back here if we needed him for a northbound train. We just bring him back here in a car and he would double right back with another train. Or if another train was coming south, we'd just leave him there and he'd protect the southbound train. That necessitated using an automobile in order to take care of the manpower.
On the PNN, they had a different type of signal system from some of the other railroads, didn't they?
We didn't have a block system. The only thing we had was a telephone semaphore system. The dispatcher had control of semaphore boards at all sidings. If you wanted to contact a train, he would throw this board ahead of him and he would stop and answer the board to see what instructions were coming up.
By throwing it, he would drop
the board.
The board, uh-huh.
To a red position. The board stood up for a clear position and dropped down to a
horizontal
level. Or stop. Then a clearance card and turn on the system or something like that also.
Now, when the conductor would call the dispatcher, you know, was the telephone system such that he could carry on a conversation with the dispatcher?
Which?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good clear telephone system we talked to. You might copy an order, you might copy a thing on changing the meat. Or you might tell him that he would record that right on the train sheet with the statute. The train already being in line, and they stood up and copied it and over and under the pizza. They being a misunderstanding as to what this conductor repeated what he did, and then you have to have that on paper in order to repeat it. And it could be a mix-up across it between the operator and the conductor and the dispatcher and the conductor, whichever it is. Very clear. We have very few problems originating on our train order system because we use the public. There's two types of train orders. One is called a 19 order, which is a handout order. Put them on a hook and tie them. The fireman or the engineer reaches out and picks up that order. Now, on a 31 order, it's got to be signed for, so you've got to stop and sign for the 31 order.
Now, when they merged with the Seaboard, did the Seaboard put in a block system up through there? Or did they maintain that center?
No, they didn't do either. They just strictly operating by radio. All together. They tore out the old semaphore system, throw down the telephone system, and operate strictly by radio. However, they can do that and save money in as much as they don't have any few trains like we had, because they're handling their through trains from the rest of the through Spartanburg and through Greenwood. So they just set off what they want us to have, you know, and they're running one train out of Spartanburg with bringing stuff over here, a train out of Greenwood with bringing stuff to Greenwood, then they'll turn around and go back, or you just operate a switcher out here. A switcher, say he goes to work here, and he go down as far as Malden or Simpsonville, or he'll go on as far as Greer, or he'll go down as far as Piedmont or Thousand, turn around and come back here and finish up the day. You're not meeting trains like we have in our day, because we're not having two trains. We had anywhere from, even when we merged it, well, we had 62 trains a day, all of them meet some further.
Well, they serve an extension of the yard services in some areas on that track?
No, no, they didn't widen the yard service. What they did, they just put on yard switchers with lights to switch so far. Say working limits between, we don't say Greenville, we say River Junction. Between River Junction and Piedmont, or between River Junction and Greer, and return. So that gives him a right then to work anywhere between Greer and River Junction, or between Piedmont and River Junction. Even though he's out of yard limits, well, he's still has operating rights in that territory.
Okay, now on the Southern, as I understand it, the mainline men are not allowed to work the yard. The seniority builds up.
That's
now,
right.
On the Seaboard, do they have the same rule?
They do over on their main line, but it doesn't work here on the old sea and Nevis Sea, or either on the Piedmont North. Because they all have road seniority.
Okay.
And by having road seniority and working out of the yard, well, that gives them, in other words, they can switch right here in the yard, or they can go. We never had any what we call strictly yard service. We had yard switchers, and as long as you call them road switchers, then you can use them in the yard. It all boils down to whatever kind of contract you've got with labor.
Were you ever in on any negotiations with the labor?
Oh, yes.
In the railroad? What would they be like?
Well, It's strictly a bargaining meeting where you rail your labor heads asking for all they can get and management denying all they can get away with. So it's just a question of getting your heads together. It can get real interesting at times, as well as investigations for discipline is applied. That can get real interesting with labor representing his man who's been disciplined, and management standing pat that the man has to be disciplined because you can't put up with what he did. So that can get real interesting too.
Well, now on the PNN, what would a man be disciplined for?
Well, various things. Rougey. I don't know where you had rougey to come in.
I don't know what that is.
But that's an alcoholic brew, getting drunk.
Oh, yeah.
He could be disciplined for being late. He could be disciplined for fighting on the job. He could be disciplined for disobeying special instructions. He could be disciplined for any rule violation pertaining to train operation. I remember I had a case that was very bitter good many years ago. We have in our contract with the trainman that he would be allowed 20 minutes from lunch, provided it didn't interfere with the schedule of the training. In this particular instance, we had some perishables that we were trying to make a connection in Spartanburg with one of their perishable trains, and we're running so close on it until I issued instructions from the conductor in the air not to take the minutes until they got to Spartanburg, because they want to make a connection with these passengers. So they just deliberately violated my instructions, which was special instructions, and stopped to eat rare. And as a result, well, we missed a connection with these passengers, so I took them out of service. We had some real hot, interesting words at that investigation with the engineer's representative and with the conductor's representative. But I kept them out of service and I got ready to put them back to work, and I didn't have to pay them, so I think we did pretty well with them anyway.
How long would you keep a man out of service?
Oh, usually a week or something like that. Just a violation of special instruction. Just to let him know you meant what you said. That he wasn't going to run your job and his too.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever lose a case that where you had taken them out?
No, I never did do that. I have lost a case or two on working conditions such as that. Say for instance, we had what we call, getting back to the road switcher, we had a job where we would operate here in the River Junction Yard and go over far as Taylor's and then come back here and then work them again. Well, I lost that case that I couldn't work him after he came back into the yard. That's the only actual case that I ever lost for working.
What about injuries on the PNN? What type of injuries would you have?
Well, we were right fortunate, by and large, over the many years, in not having too many personal injuries, although we had our share of them. They would range from a turned ankle to a broken arm. Under the time that I was in the supervisor capacity, I had some bad things, but I had three men killed in collisions, and a broken arm. I never did have an amputee during that time, a leg or an arm, but I did have derailment injuries during that time.
From derailments?
Well, no, they were just like one I referred to as going over the end of this chute over here in Greer. And we had a rear-end collision down here in Belton where two trains were falling, one another too close, and one, the incoming engineer failed to have his train under proper control within yard limits and hit the rear end of another freight train. Killed the engineer. But your big personal injuries would be turn echoes and back trouble. And I had two broken arms during my time. One of them was caused by more walking into. He thought the train had gone by, but there was two flat cars between in the train that didn't have anything on them.
Mm.
And he just walked in beside his flat cars moving at night, and it knocked him down with his arm. And the other was hanging, which was contrary to all rules, reaching up on the short side of the ladder, you know, and having one arm wrapped around the top grab iron just to be able to pull himself up real good. And his foot slipped out of the bottom sill step and gave all that weight right on that arm. As you know, something had to pop.
Mm-hmm. You had some very large trestles on this arm. They were wooden trestles, or were they?
No, we didn't have any wooden trestles. I say we didn't have any wooden trusses on it. We tracked that. We did over on the Anderson Branch have one wooden truss. The rest of our trusses were the equivalent of a D-55, which is an all-steel trussel, sitting on steel piling or concrete footing the steel on the concrete.
Did you have any trouble with the upkeep of these trusses?
Nothing on the usual decking, when the cross ties and such rot out, they would put a new deck on them. Then, of course, keep the steel painted.
Mm-hmm.
You take this Henry truss, which you referred to earlier about when the pasture coach went off of it, that was the longest truss we had. It's about 1,200 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it took about 2,000 gallons of paint to paint it.
Since it was an electrical railroad, what type of electrical problems would you have encountered on that?
Primarily lightning. It was pretty obvious that, or is obvious, that high voltage on transmission lines, in my mind, there's no doubt of what that has a tendency to pull lightning to it. And then when it hits the transmission lines, then it's got to go to the first ground that it can get to. I've been operating an electric engine at night during a heavy thunderstorm. It's not unusual to see lightning strike the transmission lines and then see it take off, streaking off. Just like you've probably been in the air on airplanes and see lightning below you where you see it originate and then head to earth. But lightning on those transmission lines is the same way, just a ball of fire moving. Well, if you have to be close enough to it, about 9 times out of 10, it'll go to ground through your engine. When it does, it all depends on how strong or how much voltage is in the actual strike as to how much damage it's actually going to do. Usually what would happen when lightning would strike the engine is primarily wind up in your traction motors and shoot the ground in the traction motor, and in some cases it burned the motor completely up, in some cases I say completely burned up, I mean damage it so bad that you couldn't use it, and then you'd have to cut out that set of motors before you could move again, and in many cases you'd have to reduce tonnage because maybe you're pulling right up to full tonnage with all motors, and you've got 8 motors there, and then lightning strikes one, and of course you've got the gear two, because they run in parallel twos, and then you've got to kill a fourth of your power, so then you're going to have to reduce a fourth of your tonnage before you move in. Now, to come in on the substations, we had substations fairly well protected with lightning arresters, but even at that, a lot of times you can get some damage from lightning. And then I have seen lightning strike with such force that it would even burn your overhead down. That would probably be close to the ground where the arc caused it.
I understand they use nearly all copper wire.
Well, the carbon cutting system was copper. Mm-hmm. Aluminum or other sources that it tends to, with extreme heat that's on it, there was too much contraction, and you take aluminum and it gets real, really hot and expand awful fast. And then sometimes on the contraction, then you can get in trouble, particularly if there was a weak place in it. It would pop. I recall we had a burn down one night many years ago down here at Donald's that was caused by an ice storm just a few days before. The train coming along, arcing very heavily on the tangle, burned the trolley wire about in half. It turned awful cold on this Saturday afternoon. It started turning cold about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then about 6:30, that fire just popped right over the train. What they did is set two cars on fire, and one of them happened to be a car cotton with 125 bales of cotton in it. It was a Pennsylvania steel car. Of course, I needed them left here going to the fire. They were sitting right next to a car with propane gas, and I was scared to death. But that was a direct cause from ice burning that caused that burn down, burn up the car cotton. We were fortunate in getting the car segregated from this propane gas before it ignited the gas and blew up the whole town of Mollins.
That propane gas car, was it in the train right next to
it? Next to the car cotton.
Well, you were lucky. Now we had the main line of the Piedmont Northern from Greenwood to Spartanburg. Now there were some other branches or lines, were there?
Well, one branch from Anderson, from Belton over to Anderson, which is 11, almost 12 miles, 11, 7,
10. Was there a section, I think in the Charlotte area, that where the PNN had not completed its track?
No, that's between Spartanburg and Gastonia. It was never completed.
Mm-hmm.
No, we operated all these years between Charlotte and Gastonia, then plus a 4 mile branch over to Belmont, all between Charlotte and Gastonia. And then later on, really even as late as 1960, we built what we call the Terrell branch, primarily Bandit Cove, from up to Plant Marshall, which is 25 miles from the main line, 7 miles up to River Bend, which was one steam plant, and then the Plant Marshall plant was 25 miles from the main line to Bend. Plant Marshall at that time was one of Duke's larger plants. They burned 150 cars going a day there at that time.
Duke had a lot to do with the building of the PNN Railroad, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
Was it part of the, he had the Duke Power Plants, and was the PNN supposedly originally to service the power plants?
No, that was even before the day that our steam plants, I don't suppose, well, that might have been in the back of some of the larger men's thinking. But the original idea of Mr. James B. Duke in building the railroads, you know, he was also in charge of the tobacco plants, that is, primarily he. Duke's Mixture, you know, way back here, you know, they operated plants in both in Durham and both in Winston-Salem. And his original plans were to handle the bulkhead bulks of tobacco out of South Georgia and North Florida to the tobacco plants via the Georgia and Florida, the Piedmont and Northern, he wanted to build in both places in Winston-Salem and to Durham, to then of course in the back of his mind serving all these cotton mills, and then also that he would have an outlet for the excess power that they developed. All of this would be surplus, you know, money coming in. He operates the railroad and sells the power to operate the railroad. Our power bill for years and years, and $20,000 to $25,000 a month. And this was power that we bought from the power bill. So he had, I don't believe at that time he ever thought much about the revenue from coal we might have. He might have been able to see that much farther in the millstone than I did. But I do know that he had in mind cotton factory products in and outbound, tobacco, and that was another thing. It's not very unusual to have regular watermelon trains out of South Georgia into this area, so he probably figured out some watermelons too.
Okay.
But yeah, we sold two of our substations after we dieselized to the I can't think of the name of the railroad that operates out of Chicago. One of the few electric roads that's left, and they're still operating. Good business.
South Shore, maybe?
South Shore, yeah. Chicago South Shore. Yeah, we sold the Taylor's Mercury Arc substation and also the Piedmont Mercury Arc station to the Chicago South Shore.
What, did they just come in and completely dismantle it and move it up there? Or? This CNNW, what, Carolina Northwestern, I think you indicated earlier that they were a direct competitor.
Well, to some extent, yeah.
Well, where did this road?
Well, the CNNW of course operated between Carolina Northwestern from Chester, South Carolina, up to Lenore, I believe, and crossed us at Gastonia. And then the Blue Ridge Railroad, which operated between Dalton and Walhalla, was taken over by the CNNW. Oh, I say it's taken over. The Southern Railroad was actually engineering this thing, and I think maybe that they were making some money between Chester and Lenore, and they weren't doing too well on the Blue Ridge, so they named it CNNW. And then after a few years operation as CNNW, they changed it to the Southern Railway, and operating now under the Southern Railway instead of CNNW or Blue Ridge. and he didn't see it and didn't say where you look.
Now, what about this Georgia and Florida? Whatever happened to it?
Well, the Southern Railroad took them over I'd say around 67. But they were one of our better connections for many years after they started operating into Greenwood in the early 30s, I believe it was 32, that the Georgia and Florida come into Greenwood. And of course they split their business between the Seaboard and Southern and us. But we had a fast cutoff in there at the time from the Florida Territory for freight going to the Midwest, such as your country. And we handled for many years train loads of phosphate rock out of Florida into the CFA territory, that is Chicago, Ohio, and even as far west as Nebraska, and that area in there for fertilizer. Of course, Chicago got one of those out of and lumber. We have a world of lumber from that in the country for many years.
Mostly pulpwood?
No, we didn't have any pulp. This was finished lumber. The pulp all went the other way. Savannah, Charleston, and Jacksonville got most of it. Well, Georgetown had a big operation, big paper plant too. A lot of other, I remember they used to refer to it as Georgetown bananas. But this was a finished product. Now we handle a lot of the paper from the pulpwood mills through the overhead movement between the Georgia and Florida and the Crenshaw. That's where all of that business went to the Crenshaw and Spartanburg. Then they gave it to the CNO or N&W at Elkhorn or St. Paul. We have practically a train a day of that Georgia and Florida traffic. Like I say, phosphate, pulp paper, and lumber. But I wondered many times why as much phosphate rock has come out of the state of Florida, why the East Coast don't meet the West Coast without having to cut a channel across there. So they've been running train loads of phosphate rock out of Florida since I can remember.
What on the Piedmont? How many cars, or what was the average road tonnage, or how do you figure the number of cars over the road?
Well, we had a system of counting the revenue loads that we handle per day, and that run on a general average of around 250 loads a day.
How many?
We took what we call a 5 p.m. report, and each agent would report what he received that day. And we considered that a good day, very good.
How many?
That was on the South Carolina Division. Now, North Carolina Division would run with the coal that they ran, would run equally about the same thing.
About 250.
Around 250, sometimes as much as 300.
How many trains would that be?
Well, of course, that, generally speaking, we operated 10 and 11 crews in South Carolina, and they run about the same as the number of crews in North Carolina. It's an average of 20 crews a day.
Mm-hmm.
That would include your switchers and all. Mm-hmm.
What's the road bed like? Is it have steep grades or?
No, we had a pretty nice grade. We didn't have anything on the main line above 1.10%. Now we own some of our branch lines where we had some pretty steep grades. We had some particularly between Belmont and River Bend Steam Plant. At one time we had as much as 4% on that line. We later years, particularly after Plant Marshall was built, we had to relocate the track and cut that down to 2%. In order to get there, we had a contract with them to handle what we call train load units for 75 cars of coal in a train. So in order to get enough power to handle 75 cars, we had to reduce that grade from 4% to 2%.
Did you use helpers or pushers on any of those grades?
See, by being able to have enough power to couple to the head end, was always able to handle it all from the front end units.
Would you usually run about 2 units on the front?
No, we had run 4 units on that 75 car train. 4,600 horsepower.
Can you think of anything else that you'd like to tell us?
Well, I could probably sit here and talk till midnight and still say I enjoy talking, but I don't know what to mouth about it.
Did you ever have any interesting, ever have any other interesting experiences with the railroad?
Well, it was an interesting experience every day from the time you went to work to the time you got back home. I recall during World War II, we were handling a bunch of road builders material between while they were building what we called then the superhighway between here and Spartanburg, the Dual Lane Road. We had two set up for that, a set up at Duncan, South Carolina, and one set up at Greer, South Carolina, two different contractors. We were handling about 100 cars a day of stone, cement, and sand. And we were rushed with war goods too. Then the seaboard coastline, I mean the seaboard in those days, about 2,500 cars of company fuel on us through Spartanburg to Greenwood. And I had these two contractors set up over there. Well, we had a very small yard starting in Spartanburg. It never was built to handle anything like that. Business. The French fuel was running one coal train after another right in Spartanburg. The Southern Railroad at that time was the intermediate carrier between French fuel and ourselves. Later, of course, the tunnel was built and we did our own delivery to them and they did the delivery to us. But anyway, the Southern Railroad called me and said, "Look here, when are you going to give me a track to where I can deliver you a train of coal?" I said, "As soon as I can get a train out of here, you can have a track." But that thing went on for 2 weeks' time, and I was doubling every crew we had, I was doubling myself. Talk about something interesting. I'd have to use a passenger crew that was running in between Greenwood and Spartanburg back to Greenwood. They would come out of Greenwood at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, back to Greenwood at 9. They'd jump in their automobile, cut through the Spartanburg and get a freight train, head a freight train to Greenwood, solid train of coal for the seaboard back to Greenwood. I'd jump in the automobile, drive it back to Greenwood, jump on the passenger train at 5 o'clock in the morning, ride to Spartanburg, get up there at 8. Then I'd start another day's work. The only sleep I got for several days there was just on a long seat in the back of the passenger coach between Greenwood and Spartanburg. Those were interesting days.
When did they build that tunnel?
I believe it was completed in 65.
Very recently.
Yeah. About 10 years old.
You know...
I fought in court for 20 years.
Yeah, who fought it?
Southerners. It was an old mine to them.
Well, I was going to ask you, what did they charge to switch your trains, cars
four,
off of
$4 a car.
They did. And did they charge you to be the connecting railroad between that northern division and the southern division?
Well, we had very little business that way. All of our business went between where it's being handled from the South Carolina division to the North Carolina division.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to the agreement to the Seaboard.
Yeah, but I'm talking about up there at that Gastonia section where you had to...
Well, we did very little interchanging with traffic from here to there. Now,
We
all that business would go
okay.
To what we call the Canoca, which is a connection there, and then we would handle it to Gastonia.
Okay.
Yeah, we did very little interchange work between South Carolina Division and North Carolina Division. VIA Southern Railway.
Did they charge you for what they did? $4 a car.
Well, no, not on that. That would take, they would get the little man's haul on that. In other words, if it originated on our line and terminated on our line, then they would get the intermediate carriers, pro rata share, whatever it might be, depending on what commodity it was, depending, of course, just how much money they made out of it. But we'll say that they made about a third of the cost by being the intermediate carrier.
I wondered about that. When was this tunnel started?
I believe it was 1964.